Polly Toynbee of The Guardian, thank you for explaining the Beeb Blair business to us. Could I say by way of introduction, it's a wide open fight in England between Tony Blair and the BBC about who told the truth about the threat of Saddam Hussein in the run-up to war in Iraq. I wish we were having the same argument openly in the States. In England, the BBC said that Blair and company had sexed up the scare around Iraqi nukes and other weapons of mass destruction. Tony Blair says the BBC sexed up its accusations. Key government weapons expert David Kelly killed himself last month when the government outed him as a key source of the BBC's suspicions. So there's an awful personal price already on this question of the truth here. I should say also, Polly Toynbee, there's a raging interest among stateside bloggers in this BBC question, especially Andrew Sullivan and Instapundit, who say it was the BBC that declared war on Tony Blair. Could you score this fight after the first week of the Hutton inquiry?
Well, I'd say it's about 50-50. I think both sides have taken quite a heavy bombardment. I would say that the BBC's journalism has been a bit dented, but most of the pots and pans that have been thrown at it are by people who have their own sectional interests. 40% of our newspaper readership in this country is owned by Rupert Murdoch. Rupert Murdoch's most overriding wish is to destroy the BBC, and all of his press outlets are geared to attacking the BBC in every way they can.
What, is this politics or business?
This is business. It's because his Sky satellite system here. He says the BBC is unfair competition, that it's because it's state-subsidized. He wants to see it diminished to something like your PBS system. He wants to make it into a small voluntary subscription service and not into a national service where everybody has to pay for it. And that is a purely commercial interest. And in the end, Rupert Murdoch's interests, even his political interests, tend to be whatever will support his commercial interests. So there are a lot of the noise against the BBC, although the government started it, has also been fostered by the whole Rupert Murdoch network in this country.
Which includes the Times of London, which is still hard to get used to, but...
Oh, the Times of London has been an outrage ever since he bought it. It plays all sorts of clever games. Somebody plays a kind of cat and mouse with the government on this occasion with a kind of crocodile smile on its face. It's sort of supporting the government only so as better to attack the BBC. It sort of supports the government for as long as Tony Blair does what Murdoch says, for instance, does not go into the euro or a step closer to Europe. He waits to pounce the moment Tony Blair moves in that direction, and Rupert Murdoch is largely responsible for the fact that we are not in the eurozone. So that this whole issue about the BBC, about the government, about the media, is extraordinarily complex. Mm. It is a cat's cradle of interlocked issues of a very wicked kind. And it isn't just the BBC, the government wanting to have a go at the BBC. It goes much deeper than that. It started with the government losing their temper with the BBC. I think that probably some of Andrew Gilligan's reporting from Baghdad had always emphasized the negative. If you look back at his reports, they tended to always overemphasize the looting, its general tone. I mean, he is of the right. He's a deputy editor of The Spectator, a right-wing magazine, and that probably made the government extra suspicious and jumpy about everything he did, because he's a journalist of the right who happens to also work for the BBC, which has been another of the BBC's problems, in that they have allowed too many of their journalists to write for outside publications, which in my day they never were permitted to for these political reasons. So that there are questions about his bias or not. Nevertheless, the particular report in question so far in this investigation seems to me to have stood up very well. He said that the government had overemphasized the evidence. He said David Kelly said so. Pretty much everybody thinks that that's true. The next question, though, becomes more complicated, and whether or not Hutton will, how far he'll venture down this path is, well, to what extent would you expect the government to use all the shreds of evidence it had at its disposal in order to persuade people that this war was the right thing to be doing? Once the government had decided it was going to go for war, well, of course it would use intelligence evidence. And are we getting a bit technical in deciding precisely which bits of intelligence evidence you can lean on how hard?
It all turned, really, did it not, on the report in the September dossier that Saddam had a kind of 45-minute trigger on nuclear or other weapons of mass destruction. And David Kelly seems to have said, ain't so.
They didn't say nuclear. No, I don't think anybody... they said they feared that he would soon have nuclear capability. I don't think anybody actually said he already had. They said he'd been trying to acquire this stuff, even that he had acquired some of this stuff. But they didn't... I mean, I went to a number of briefings beforehand, and I don't think they actually said that the nuclear weapons were ready to go. And there was, of course, a great deal of debate at the time the September dossier came out about what the 45 minutes meant, what kind of weapons, what state would they be in. It's not as if everybody just took that dossier and said, goodness me, here is the absolute truth. I mean, there followed from that heated debate between those in favor of the war and those against about the precise meanings and likelihood of all of these things.
But the idea of a 45-minute trigger kind of hung in the air for months.
It did. It did. And they certainly, overused that very emphatically.
The government, you mean?
The government did. I think that one should also remember that the government was doing something that the British government had never done before, because we have a very closed system of government. We don't have a proper Freedom of Information Act. We don't have the same attitude towards information that you have in the USA. And for the first time, the government said, all right, we'll publish the intelligence information we've got. Now, this had never been done before. So the intelligence services themselves had never been subject to the idea that their hesitant, subtle, sophisticated private briefings to ministers and to departments suddenly had to appear in a public form, so that the very process of writing such a dossier was always going to be problematic for them, the shadowy people, the spooks. And they'd never seen the bright light of day before, and certainly never had their information put in that way before. It's always done by, discussion, evidence to committees, hints, suggestions, probabilities. And suddenly everything had to be rather hardened up. The public want to know, what have you got? And so that I think that part of the problem of what we're dealing with here is trying to hammer out in black and white what was always grey but used to be hidden. And this time, at least to the government's credit, they tried to bring it out in public. I don't think anybody ever tried again, because maybe intelligence information just can't be subjected to this kind of yes or no.
But they did bring it out in different versions. There was an early September version and then a late September version, and there's no question, it seems to me now, that they did hype it, strengthen it, exaggerate it, sex it up, or whatever, in the interim.
Yep, and it certainly had some sort of internal inconsistencies in the final version, which suggested that it had been through several versions. I mean, it was not a very good document. And an awful lot of people at the time it came out said they didn't think it was a very good document either. It is not amazing that a lot of people inside, and high-up people inside the Department of Defense, would have thought it was not a good document. And that was always so, whether Andrew Gilligan or David Kelly said it or not.
Well, another point that's clear now is that David Kelly, a man that everybody seemed to trust, had used that phrase, sexing it up. He did express the misgivings, as you say, of others in the government. He'd shared the view with Susan Watts of the BBC, Gavin Hewitt of the BBC, and probably others. The other news of the inquiry so far, it seems to be, it's especially interesting, is that it's clear now that it was the government, with Prime Minister Blair taking an active interest, that outed David Kelly, and it was putting an awful lot of heat on him to toe the line for his future. As I read them, these are all confirmations of the basic thrust of what the BBC reported.
Well, yes, the guy told, he was a whistleblower, and he told a lot of people his story that he thought the dossier, the evidence in the dossier, had been over-egged, hyped up, sexed up. That's true. I would guess that quite a lot of other professionals in his line of business probably thought the same. What he may have misspoke on is knowing exactly how this process happened. And by think, because he wasn't there, he was not at the relevant meetings, by saying specifically, Alistair Campbell, the Prime Minister's man, himself, put these things in, ordered it to be so, it may be something a lot more subtle than that. It may be that, after all, the intelligence services themselves know which side their bread's buttered. They know what their masters want. They are trying to deliver stuff that their masters want. This dossier went through the Intelligence Committee, chaired by John Scarlett, who is, you know, a rigorous man, top spook, and he passed it. Now, to what extent they themselves sexed up their own document knowing it's what the politicians wanted, to what extent, you know, it was the atmosphere around, to what extent you can't really put out a document that looks very... Because the intelligence services themselves look slightly silly if they admit all that they don't know, and everything comes with huge caveats, and they put out a document that really demonstrates how little they know, which, of course, was very little. Their intelligence, you know, as U.S. intelligence in Iraq has been phenomenally thin and weak. To what extent they themselves quite wanted to soup it up when they saw it in the cold light of day and thought this doesn't look much for the amount of money we spend on intelligence services. So I think it's possible that Kelly... knew that he had probably over-exaggerated what he knew about who did it. And the idea that there are these wonderful, innocent, totally purity-driven Snow intelligence services who have been wickedly forced to do something by the evil politicians just might not be that simple.
Hmm. Who do the people believe, do you think, for exaggerating things? Was it the BBC who sexed it up, or Tony Blair?
I think a bit of both. I mean, I think they certainly believe that the politicians, they will always be believe bad of politicians. They will certainly believe, unless WMD turn up soon, that Tony Blair exaggerated it. They may believe partly that he got it wrong, that he persuaded himself. They will believe that certainly that he exaggerated it, and that increasingly as time goes on, they may believe the whole thing was a mistake. I think there has certainly been enough mud slung at the BBC for a lot of people without any clear idea why to have a vague feeling the BBC's journalism has been questioned and have a little less trust in it. But on the other hand, given the state of British journalism, where else do they have to turn to? The BBC is the best they've got. And in moments of national crisis or when things are really serious, people all turn on the BBC because it's actually still what they trust most. So I think the BBC will tidy up its act a bit and will do fine. I think the government, well, we wait to see to the end of this inquiry. Tony Blair himself appears in the final phases of it and will be having to speak for his life, in a sense, in explaining what he thought of the evidence, what he made of it, how he used it.
I'm fascinated that bloggers have sort of declared war, some of them, on not just the BBC, but in this country on the New York Times. I think bloggers were part of the force that brought a big, big change at the senior management of the New York Times. The best and most reputable of our journalistic institutions are taking an awful lot of heat from the new media. What do you make of that?
I think that's very interesting. I mean, mind you, the New York Times episode was watched from over here with kind of wry bemusement. I mean, the standards of excellence that is exposed in terms of its checking and all the rest of it, you know, somebody had slipped through the loophole and made fun of them. I mean, we didn't even begin to have those standards to start with over here. You know, you look at the Murdoch Press, the Murdoch Times, the Murdoch Sun, the Murdoch News of the World. I mean, just forget it. We have a so-called press code of ethics, but it's a joke. It starts with, you know, newspapers will attempt to tell the truth at all times. In this country, our press is so devious, politicized. It is, nearly all the newspapers are political weapons, mostly directed against the government. That the idea of that kind of honesty, we were just sort of agog and fascinated by.
Well, that's interesting. I associate the British press with, you know, bare bosoms on in a lot of the tabloid press, but rather a cautious approach to challenging the government in a sustained way, as the BBC has been doing.
Oh, no. I think absolutely not. I mean, you know, the Independent, which used to be independent, is day after day after day, front page, attack, attack, attack. The Daily Mirror, which used to be, you know, is traditionally a paper of the left, tabloid, you know, usually a Labour government supporter, has been absolutely anti the government, has gone the other way. They found that basically to sell newspapers, it's always easier to attack. Country is in a very, very competitive. Luckily, the New York Times sits alone in stately magnificence, so does the Washington Post. You know, your great newspapers don't suffer from intense competition in an upmarket market. And whereas our newspapers, our so-called great newspapers, are fighting themselves down into a spiral downwards for a shrinking market, And attack journalism has just become the name of the game. I mean, ever since Rupert Murdoch brought up the Times and came into the British press scene, it has pretty much destroyed most of our newspapers. And The Guardian's lucky because we don't have an owner. We are a small paper which is run by a self-perpetuating trust and has no political owner. And it's traditionally a left-of-center paper with a large spectrum of opinion on the left, from the far left to the center left. It is not affiliated to the government. It tends to be what it calls a critical friend and is probably more critical than friendly most of the time. But most of the rest of the press now has sort of gone berserk in its attack on a government that remains amazingly really quite popular and really quite successful.
To me, the surprising thing on this side of the ocean is how uncritical the big media have been in the aftermath of a lot of exaggeration about weapons of mass destruction and hyping of the case for the war. We have not had the kind of inquiry that may have been triggered, alas, in your case, by the death of David Kelly.
Well, I'm amazed. I mean, we sit here looking across the Atlantic very sadly saying, where are the Democrats? Where is the noise? Where are the papers that we expect? Where are the commentators we expect? I mean, I'm very interested to read, you know, Thomas Friedman's reports from Baghdad. I think they've been extremely good and quite critical about things that are going wrong there. But nevertheless, there still seems to be this omerta, this 9/11 holier than holies, nobody dare say a word, about a foreign policy that is grossly damaging the United States' position in the world and undermining its security, making it a target wherever it may be, well into the far future. And I think the rest of Europe sits there pretty appalled. And in Britain, a lot of people sit there pretty appalled that somehow or another, Tony Blair has managed to ally himself with America in the misguided idea that he can somehow pull them back from worst excesses. Whereas a lot of us, I think, on the left, a lot of Labour Party backbenchers, a lot of Labour Party MPs, would have rather see him try to build a European coalition and work together to counterbalance some of the American foreign policy.
A lot of the critical inquiry that you're missing in the conventional press is alive and well, I must say, in the blogosphere.
Oh, I mean, I get amazing amounts of stuff, huge amount of stuff all the time. But a lot of it completely wacky conspiracy stuff. You know, David Kelly was murdered, Bush organized 9/11. I mean, you get a great deal of stuff swishing about of a strange kind, which is in a way a shame because it often undermines the really rather thoughtful and serious stuff that there is that's being said out loud of a critical kind from the liberal wing in America. It's often overwhelmed by the fruitcake.
Yeah, that's always a danger. But there's skepticism and intelligence and passion out there, too.
True. That's
who's,
true.
Who's going to pay the price of the sins that were committed? Let me ask it a different way. I mean, this famously state-supported BBC is obviously biting the hand that feeds it in this case. Can it get away with that kind of critical barking at its own government?
Yes, up to a point. But you see, you mustn't put them just being in a position of being, you know, a noble, outspoken voice. What's happened is the opposite, that nearly all the British press, because it's all conservative-owned, is rather the way the sort of Kenneth Starr-type attitude towards Clinton is set upon the destruction of Tony Blair. It is an antagonistic press. It's much, to put it in the current lingo, much sexier to sell newspapers that attack the government. Yet again, the government is wrong, wrong, wrong on this and that and the other. It's corrupt. The journalists, the politicians are corrupt. Attack journalism is easier and it's more fun and it sells newspapers. And there is now such a vehement climate of attack that what happened was at the BBC that used to stand really quite fairly analysing particular issues, what was going well, what was not, has somewhat been drawn into that fever. And they shouldn't be there. They should be in a place that criticises the government when the government does something wrong, but also is even-handed in terms of things that go well. And I think there has been a flavour of late. It's very difficult for them not to be pulled into the great same media circus as everybody else. They've been pulled a little bit too far into that. I mean, they should stand apart. They are not partisan. Of course, they should be investigative and thorough, but there's been a little bit There's been not enough even-handedness, I think. But it's marginal, and they'll pull that back quite quickly. This has given them a terrible shock. And I think we'll see slightly more restrained reporting in future. That doesn't mean not fearless investigations when they've got a good story, but it means not a kind of knee-jerk attitude that you were getting on the Today program, which is the program that caused all this trouble, where every single politician that came on was simply torn to pieces by the interviewers without even hardly giving them a word to speak. If they were a Labour politician, you know, why have you done this, 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 and this on every issue? Slightly more chance to let the minister speak, explain what the policy is, explain what happened, not happened, and a slightly more inquiring frame of mind than a purely attack one. But this is, you know, this is small stuff. I mean, compared to the rest of British journalism, the BBC is still stands out as a beacon of excellence.
Well, long may it wave. Could I just say the Guardian has a lot of American readers, and we note your great interest in blogs. I wonder who in the Guardian, but who elsewhere in British commentary should we trust for a verdict on Tony Blair versus the BBC?
I think the Financial Times is probably, as well as the Guardian, the most fair-minded at the moment. They are a paper that's pretty neutral. In fact, last election suggested voting for Tony Blair, but you couldn't be called of the left. But their reporting is very, very straight. It's rather more on the American model. And I think their commentators are excellent, Philip Stevens. And, you know, you shouldn't be misled. It's not like the Wall Street Journal one bit, which is of the far right, shouldn't be misled by its title. It is a brilliant newspaper of which the financial aspects are only part of it. And well worth turning to that website and looking at what they have to say, because I would always pretty much trust their editorials. And we don't know which way this is going. There's a lot further to go in this whole investigation, and we have no idea what the conclusions would be. I think I'm pretty glad I'm not Lord Hutton having to call this one at the end of the day.
I'm very grateful to you for looking at it for us. Thank you very, very much. Polly Toynbee, we associate the name Toynbee with the long view of important issues, and you've upheld the family tradition.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.